You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, May 19th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Great program for you today. Joining me, Professor Eddie Gloud of Princeton, to discuss, among other things, the very controversial interview Cornel West gave to Chris Hedges. Then, just following the president's address from the State Department on U.S. Middle East policy, slated to be 11:40 a.m., we will be talking to Matt Duss, director of Middle East Progress at the Center for American Progress, who is in Tel Aviv, I believe. Didn't mean to make that rhyme. Ladies and gentlemen, we're a jam-packed program today. And, of course, in the post-show, you can always give me a call. Maybe we'll take a call before then at 646-257-3920. And you can IM me at Majority FM in the post-show. Just one little bit of house cleaning. Got a wonderful offer from a Majority Report listener. We will put his email on the site. It's a guy named Ben at politicallyme@yahoo.com. I would like to offer assistance to all Majority Report listeners who are currently out of work. Alongside my actual career, I'm a freelance employment counselor with an emphasis on the free part. I'm not a miracle worker. I can't change the economy. I can't give you money. But I am willing to offer support, advice, job leads, and connections at no cost. Seriously, any listeners out of work can feel free to drop me a line. I'll do what I can do to help. There you have it. We'll put that on the site. Very nice offer. Let me get into some of the comments from this Cornel West interview before we take a break and bring on Professor Eddie Gloud. Cornel West is, of course, a widely known professor of African-American studies at Princeton, formerly at Harvard. He gave an interview to Chris Hedges where he expressed a lot of frustration with President Obama, both on a political level and on a personal level. I'm not going to get into the personal stuff too much, but he's a guy who campaigned, went to, I guess, 65 campaign events for Obama and, felt slighted. To me, that's not terribly relevant in the piece because I think his political criticisms are valid. He feels betrayed on a political level in terms of, and I think which many of us share, in terms of Obama never meeting the sometimes populist rhetoric that he espoused during the campaign. It wasn't extreme populist rhetoric. There was some. He did say things like, I will put my soft shoes on and walk with unions if their right to collectively bargain is threatened. And we're seeing it all across the country. He certainly has bought into the entire deficit as opposed to jobs is the emergency frame. His Justice Department has been extremely non-responsive in terms of pursuing the banksters. He certainly followed a Rubenite course in terms of the too big to fail banks. He did not pursue an aggressive policy of helping out homeowners. All of this is in part of Cornel West's critique. I'm expanding a little bit on it, but I think that's a fair characterization. And the part that has become controversial, and we'll talk to Eddie Glaude about this too, and it's more academic in some respects, but he says, I think my dear brother Barack Obama has a certain fear of free black men. It's understandable. As a young brother who grows up in a white context, brilliant African father, he's always had a fear of being a white man with black skin. All he has known culturally is white. He's just as human as I am, but that is his cultural formation. And I'll save some of that for Professor Glaude as we take a break to give him a call right now. So we'll be back in just a moment with Professor Eddie Glaude. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It has been too long. A frequent guest back on the Seder on Sundays and some of the Sam Seder shows back in the day. Professor Eddie Glaude, he is a religion and African-American studies professor from Princeton University. Welcome to the program, sir.
It's always a pleasure. It's been too long.
I know. It certainly has. And frankly, I've been meaning to have you on the program. And this interview reminded me, frankly. And so I'm glad we have an opportunity to talk about it. And, you know, we don't have too much time, so I don't want to go over the entirety of this. I've read some of the comments by Professor West, and you know, to a large extent, I think, at least personally, and I don't want to speak for my audience, but I think there's certainly a sense that President Obama has been a political disappointment for progressives, specifically in the financial realm, and. I want to go over a couple of things that he talked, because this is a really fascinating, this is a very fascinating topic to me, because one of the things about Obama that has completely befuddled me from the beginning, and while I thought that, you know, Professor West makes reference to, he had faith in some sense that President Obama was aggressively populist and progressive, despite the fact that he had a rather centrist brief Senate career. And he mentions Lieberman, which, of course, was certainly a had stuck in my craw at the time, too. But he goes on to say that that President Obama feels most comfortable with upper-class, middle, white, and Jewish men who consider themselves very smart, very savvy, very effective in getting what they want. He's referring to guys like Larry Summers, and I presume, you know, guys like Robert Rubin, and people like Geithner, and which it's a critique that I have heard from both a political perspective. And when you get into the sort of the psychology behind it from an economic perspective, in that Obama came from fairly modest, humble beginnings, not unlike Bill Clinton, and sees these guys, these masters of the universe, as really deserving their positions and buying into the meritocracy. Professor West takes it from his perspective within the context of President Obama being a child of a mixed race couple. And I'm curious, give me your sense of of your sense of what Professor West had to say.
Well, you know, first, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you and your audience. It just seems to me that we have to divide the piece into at least two parts. One is the kind of personal dimension where there is a sense in which Professor West gives voice to his own sense, his own feeling of being used and manipulated, in the sense that he stumped for President Obama, found himself out there working on his behalf, unlike some of the responses out in the world, whether it's the Nation piece by Professor Harris Perry or others on Twitter or on the internet. Professor West, his relationship with President Obama did not fall apart after the State of the Black Union with the rift between Obama and Tavis Smiley. In fact, in Ohio, on the night of the election, when he won office, Professor West was stumping for him in Ohio. And speaking for him in Ohio, organizing for him in Ohio. So part of what you see in the first part is this kind of personal, very pained account of his own sense of betrayal, personal betrayal, that gets kind of it gets represented by this, what I take to be bad racial reasoning. And Cornell and I have talked about this face-to-face, that there's some the account of Obama being culturally white. Its truth value, whether it's true or not, nothing follows from that in terms of the policy. What you see is Professor West really venting his sense of being used and manipulated. Then the second part of the piece.
Right. I should say about that my sense is that, listen, we're talking about people who are very public people who obviously have healthy egos. And that is almost the most mundane part of the entire piece to me.
Absolutely.
This happens all the time. And we hear about it and sometimes we don't. Everybody, the one thing that has amazed me since I started doing this 8, 9 years ago is hearing just how personal things work on this level. And, you know, a guy goes out 65 times, uses his public persona. I don't fault him for feeling that, and I don't know that it really has much of a bearing on his political critique, frankly.
Right, and so, which takes us to the second part. And the second part has something to do with the fact that many progressives, whatever we mean by that word, right, green, you know, and I'm using Professor Melissa Harris Perry's language here, green-screened Obama. And what I mean by that is that, you know, you can put a green screen on an actor or an actress, and they could be in any scene.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, we green-screened him. We made Obama seem like he was the anti-war candidate. We made Obama seem like he was a kind of, you know, progressive figure who would challenge Wall Street, who would speak on behalf of the poor and the disenfranchised, right? And all along, President Obama, or then-candidate Obama, was presenting a rather centrist platform. And so what you see in West is deep disappointment rooted in what I take to be a very serious critique that we need to kind of rest and wrestle with, and that is that the current policies coming out of the White House and out of the Congress, right, are policies that are not addressing the most vulnerable Black poor people, not addressing poor people generally, that we see policies that A, continue the war machine, B, that benefit those on Wall Street, record profits,
mm-hmm.
And that there's capitulation and compromise in the name of some odd notion of breaking through the dysfunction of Washington, D.C., but that this notion seems to be, at least on my view, Brother Sam, seems to take the place on the backs of working poor people. And so what you see is this righteous indignation that Professor West expresses in the second part of the piece around the failures of President Obama's policies. And so you can talk to TARP, you can talk about TARP, you can talk about passage of health care, you can talk about the Lilly Leadbelly legislation, you could talk about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But every time people kind of run the gamut of what he's done, you kind of ask yourself the question, Sam, but what about poor people?
Right.
What about the most vulnerable? What about the fact that there's 28% unemployment, for the most part, in Black communities across this country? Why can't we talk about this? And what you get is this really odd response that to do so is to engage in some kind of black identity politics, to expect him as the black president to speak to black people. And then you say, oh, wow, this seems to be shutting down critical conversations about how to address the social misery of black communities, because to address it specifically somehow means you're engaging in identity politics, when in fact what you're trying to do is address misery.
You know, and it's interesting to me because his political critique is no, I don't see much daylight between that critique of Obama's policies than something Robert Reich might write, frankly.
Exactly.
And so, you know, the idea that, President Obama's Treasury Department rolls out HAMP, which is the home. Look, he made a decision at one point where they were either going to bail out the banks or they were going to go directly to the root of the problem, bail out the homeowners, which would have had a positive impact on the banks, but wouldn't have fed them directly. And I don't think there's any progressive out there who can deny the idea that he surrounded himself with Reubenites, neoliberal economists, who have prescribed a fix for the economy that is that considers the plight of the banks and the financial industries primarily. And
absolutely, Brother Sam. And what's interesting, let's just talk about this in comparison to the Republican Party, right? You can have Tea Partiers, right? People who are concerned about big government, folks who are organized, many of around their own nativistic claims, their own concerns about losing ground, and they organize and they bring pressure to bear on the party establishment. They organize and they run people against candidates, and they're doing it within the context of the Republican Party. But when it comes to progressive voices within the Democratic Party, we're always told to toe the line, that we can't in some ways bring critique to bear, that we can't bring pressure to bear on what the DNC is doing, on what the White House is doing, on what the leadership, the Democratic leadership in the Congress, are, what they're doing. It seems to me that progressive voices, whether white, black, brown, or yellow, we need to be speaking and yelling as loudly as we can on behalf of the most vulnerable in relation not only to this economic policy that has left banks to be, these big banks that can't too big to fail, they're still in place, that really feed the pockets of Wall Street oligarchs, as Cornell would say, and leave, shall we say, to wallow in misery those folk who can't seem to find their job, can't seem to find employment, those folk who are losing their homes, those middle-class folk who see that the future of their children, right, isn't as bright as their own present, right? And so we need to be speaking loudly and bringing pressure to bear. And the only thing that these folk do, it sounds like DLC stuff to me, mm-hmm. right, is to say, you need to support us because this is the outcome. No one is saying that to the Tea Party folks.
Yeah, and, it's
right?
interesting.
And I'm not trying to, because they're organized.
I hate to,
they're,
you know,
organizing and bringing pressure to bear.
I hate to, you know, bring up Robert Reich again, but literally the last line of his last piece on his blog was, which leads to a more basic question. Are we ready and willing to mount primary challenges to incumbent Democrats who cave? He's talking
exactly.
specifically about the so-called debt negotiations. We all know the Republicans are going to raise the debt limit ceiling, but yet we're seeing the Democrats and President Obama negotiating, involved in this kabuki theater. And so, you know, I think that part of it, to me, again, is not controversial. The interesting thing, and I want to get into this, and this is a sort of a more esoteric conversation, because I had a conversation with a fairly established Politico type who we were talking about this idea that Obama has surrounded himself with these Reubenites type of people. And he was looking at it from very much from this economic standpoint. And he said, look, you know, I grew up with these people. I know these people. They cheated tennis and they were all C students. I don't believe that they necessarily belong where they are. I'm aware of the benefits that they had to get there. And this guy was saying that he feels, now we're getting into sort of a psychoanalysis on some level, but it's a legitimate question that people have. Maybe it's more of a historical one, but he says, I think because Obama came from modest beginnings, that when he to in getting in rising through these systems, becoming you know, you don't get elected the first black head of the Harvard Law Review without understanding the dynamics that are going on, without having a certain respect for the institution, and perhaps a certain blindness or a willingness to ignore certain elements of that institution, because it's hard to succeed in an institution while you're critiquing it simultaneously. And you know, this is the part that sort of interests me, just from a sort of almost an academic perspective, is this analysis. And
I mean,
go ahead.
I try, you know, I understand the path that you're going down, Sam. I try to avoid it in the sense that I can't get into the mind of President Obama. I don't understand. I can't say for with any degree of certainty what his intentions are, what motivates him to do X, Y, and Z. As a pragmatist, I can only look at the fruits of his policy.
Right.
We can only chart, right? We can begin to get some indication of his philosophy of governance by looking at what he's doing. And what we do know is that poor people, middle-class people, and we know that these terms are and how they're measured and defined in the public conversation, that they're fluid. But the people who are singled out by these words, people who are poor, people who are struggling in the middle class, that the current policies coming out of D.C., coming out of the Beltway, are not helping them. People can say, well, he saved the country from the economic brink, right? He pulled us from the economic brink. Okay, we can grant that. We can say that health care reform, right, opens up, was a fundamental historic transformation of the health care system. We can say he made a gesture in this regard. We can say ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell means something, right? We can talk about what he's trying to do with regards to student loans. But when we're talking about jobs, when we're talking about what the public option meant for poor people and how he compromised on that, when we talk about financial regulatory reform and how he's backed down and allowed too big to fail to continue, all of this robbing Main Street that is divided by tracks, that's divided by poor neighborhoods and rich neighborhoods, when we talk about the most vulnerable in America and we look at the policies, not only coming from the Congress, but the policies that are coming from the White House, it is the basis of making a substantive and significant and perhaps harsh judgment of Obama's philosophy of governance. And I think progressive voices, Brother Sam, and this is where I thoroughly agree with Robert Reich, progressive voices, we cannot cower under the assumption that we have no other choice.
And
this is not the case.
And I would add that the other aspect of that equation that you're outlining is that there was a unique and, I believe, extremely rare. We may never see one, at least in my lifetime, in your lifetime again, where there was a mandate, I believe, for a much greater change. There was a unique opportunity coming off of 8 years of Republican rule, where we had seen the massive amounts of corruption of our entire system of increased corporate control at a time where there was a crossroads in a moment, and I believe that moment's passed, sadly, where there could have been some fundamental change. I mean, forgive me for using that word, but I think you know, the idea of change, people, I agree, it was a green screen. We projected a lot of things onto that, but it must have meant something. And
yeah,
we don't
absolutely see.
I mean, go ahead.
No, absolutely. I don't know the energy of young people that was so much on display during the 2008 election. The record turnout of African Americans, the energy around the election itself, all kind of signaled that perhaps we were turning a corner. As a nation, that the possibility of fundamental change, in other words, kind of breaking the back of the Reagan Revolution that has defined not only the Republican Party, but has defined the Democratic Party's response to the future of the nation. We thought that the back was perhaps broken, or we had broken through. But what we see is, in interesting sorts of ways, not just simply remnants, Brother Sam, of the status quo, but we've just seen, shall we say, things just as they are, as they were. I mean, it looks like it's all the same, with just different characters in place. So DLC triangulation is still taking place. People are breaking, bolting to the center, and now the center is actually right. And again, I keep hitting on this because this is what was so important, and I regret that folks are talking about the personal part of Cornell's piece with Chris Hedges. But what's really important is that we don't hear the voices of folk really crying out on behalf of poor people, on behalf of those who are most vulnerable in this moment. Instead, what we have are people closing ranks around Obama and attacking and engaging in a kind of mob mentality to dismiss someone like Cornel West, who's been a stalwart figure on the left, who's been an extraordinarily important voice for progressive force, for progressive politics in this country for well over 30 years.
Do you think it's illegitimate for members of the black community to have an expectation that President Obama would be more sensitive to the plight of African Americans in this country than a white president? I mean, do you think that's an illegitimate expectation?
No, I don't think it's an illegitimate expectation. I mean, Stanley Fish a while back wrote a couple of pieces on identity politics in the New York Times. And what was interesting about his piece, he says there's a kind of base level of identity politics that makes perfect sense to him, and that is that there's a presumption on the part of certain people that people who have their group experience, who look like them, who are ethnically or racially coded in a certain sort of way, right, we can assume that they would at least be sensitive to the issues that confront that community. Beyond that, one shouldn't expect that what follows from that are the same values, the same policies, the same politics. Because you're black doesn't mean you hold the same positions,
right.
But there's a sense in which one can presume that no matter where you come from that group, if there's another person who identifies with that group, that there's a presumption of, well, there should be some sensitivity, some knowledge, right?
Right. I mean, as a society, I don't think there was anybody hesitated saying that John McCain had a better understanding of military issues because he was from the military. I mean,
right, or Joe Lieberman.
Right.
Could do could be thought of in similar ways in relation to Jewish communities, right?
Absolutely.
This is why it's so important this is why it was such an important thing, or Geraldine Ferraro, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is why these were historic nominations in some ways, right? But what's interesting, this is part of the neoliberal containment of race in the United States at this point, right? And that is that we can't talk about race in the public domain without fearing, the kind of counterclaim, Brother Sam, that we're engaging in reverse racism.
Right.
And so there's, on the one hand, what's going on, there's this two-sided move that's taking place. On the one hand, there's a kind of sense, well, look, he's our first black president. We don't need to be complicitous in all of this racist critique coming at him. We need to surround him and protect him. We know he can't do much. And in that particular view, which is rooted and grounded in a certain kind of problematic identity politics, silences criticism. Then there's the other side, when people say, well, what are we to do about black suffering in the country? How are we to speak specifically to what's going on in urban cities, what's happening to black farmers, what's happening to black kids in the juvenile system, what's happening to black women and men in the prison industrial complex, what's happening to their children once they are incarcerated, what's going on? When we begin to talk about those specific sorts of issues, people then say, well, you can't hail the president in that way because he's the president of all Americans,
mm-hmm.
right? So what happens? The typical form of interest group politics, when Hispanic organizations say to President Obama, you need to do something about immigration, and within the week we have a speech on immigration. When people, LGBT communities, approach Obama and say, we need to address that, or don't ask, don't tell, and he addresses it, boom, this is interest group politics. When unions say we need to speak in this way and that way with regards to workers, and he responds, boom. But when African American communities held the president in light of their condition. He's the president of all Americans. Well, no one was saying that in relation to Hispanic organizations. No one was saying that in relation to LGBT groups. No one was saying that in relation to working unions. So what you get is this really interesting containment of race politics in the United States, which leaves communities, poor black people in particular, Brother Sam, poor black communities that are extraordinarily vulnerable in this moment, right, subject to all sorts of silences and lack of attention, if that makes sense.
Well, two things occur to me. One is in the run up to the 2008 election, my partner at the time at Air America, Mark Maron, had a great joke that said that finally black Americans will have the opportunity to be screwed by one of their own. But at the same time, I will also say that while I think you're right in terms of the responsiveness from those different groups, I think that as a group, and perhaps the dynamic you're talking about has made it more difficult to sort of garner this type of energy. But those groups, the LGBT community, the Hispanic community, these are all groups that have been very, very active and have put a lot of pressure on it. I mean, the LGBT community, you had people chaining themselves to the White House, the White House gates.
Right.
I mean, and it's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, we may not know really the verdict of the black community until we see what happens in 2012 when we look at things like turnout or because
exactly.
There clearly does not seem to be, from my perspective, any type of concerted effort within the leadership of the black community to really pressure Obama about these issues that you're talking about in the way that I've seen other communities do that. And maybe they are in some ways prevented from doing this because of that dynamic you're referring to.
Well, this is really important because remember the other side of the coin was not just simply the president can't address specifically the issues of black people. The other side of the coin is let's not critique him because then we become complicitous with racist critiques of him. Mm-hmm. So there's a way in which, but also I think it's really important. We need to stop being so Obama obsessed, right? And that is part of what we need to do is to understand what it means to organize, what it means to be engaged in grassroots organization in our communities, both local, state, and nationally. What does it mean to hold not only President Obama accountable, but the so-called civil rights establishment, our political leaders, to hold the Congressional Black Caucus? I mean, what are they doing specifically? So part of what I think we're experiencing, Sam, is a nadir in African-American politics. We're experiencing the lowest point. A low point, right? A crisis in the African American political class, and I think we're experiencing a crisis in the African American intellectual class. When Professor Melissa Harris Perry, and I name her because she wrote the piece in The right. Nation, when she writes this piece and she responds on the Ed Schultz show, she basically said this: 85% of African Americans support Obama. Why don't we trust them? Right? And it's interesting that this is not the kind of complaint that a response that progressives would give when they read what went wrong with Kansas.
Right.
Right. You know, this is not the response that we give, we offer when we see that a large number of Americans voted for George W. Bush. No, what we do is we organize, we try to put out the information that will enable everyday ordinary folks to kind of see how power is functioning and operating. We don't condescend, but we want to convince them otherwise.
Right. So I mean, people could say the same thing to her. I mean, I don't mean to single her out, but people could say the same thing to me as a progressive. Something like 80, 85% of progressives still support self-identified liberals, still support, are still very supportive of Obama. So I think that critique is misses the point, but we have got to go.
I appreciate the conversation.
Well,
Doc,
I'd like to continue this in the near future. It's fascinating stuff, and I think it's a conversation that we don't hear enough. And I commend Professor West for raising it because the cruel twist here is that the plight of the African American community in some respects has a harder time expressing itself in this era than it might otherwise.
Exactly. And we've always been the canary in the mine, as Lonnie Guinier said. And so the desperation that the country is experiencing, you can imagine the depths of that desperation that's taking place in black communities throughout this country.
Professor Eddie Gloud from Princeton, thanks so much for joining us. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. You guys take care.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Matt Duss in Tel Aviv on President Obama's Middle East speech. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone from Tel Aviv, ladies and gentlemen, is Matt Duss. He is the director of the Middle East Progress at the Center for American Progress. We're still waiting for President Obama's speech, but be that as it may, we have at least a sort of the broad outlines of what he's going to talk about today. Matt, give me your sense of what he's going to be talking about and what he should be talking about.
Well, the speech is being billed as President Obama kind of laying out U.S. policy and U.S. strategy to a new Middle East. I mean, obviously, over the past months, we've seen a series of uprisings in Arab countries. President Obama, after having kind of made halting steps to change U.S. policy, hopefully this speech is going to lay out a more kind of consistent and unified vision of what the U.S. is going to do in the region.
Now, I mean, the reports are that he's going to be talking about, he's going to be basically dividing the speech into three different parts. One is sort of to provide some type of historical context about the U.S. relationship with the region. How important is that? Why would that be important?
Well, again, I think that is very important just because the role of the U.S. in the region has created a lot of bad feeling in the region. I think one of the things, and to give some credit to the Bush administration here, perhaps surprisingly coming from me, is that, you know, I think after 9/11, they did have an analysis of the fact that the U.S. policy, U.S. historical support for decades for authoritarian dictators who oppressed their own people produced hatred and extremism and terrorism that visited us here in the United States so horribly on 9/11. unfortunately, having made this analysis, their answer to the problem was to go and invade countries in the Middle East, and actually, I think, made the problem worse. But that is still, the fact is, I think they analyzed the problem correctly, and I think it's really kind of become a consensus view here in the United States that even though supporting dictators who promise to keep, you know, who promise to keep the oil flowing and keep radical Muslims from taking over these countries might be good in the short term, in the long term, it's just not sustainable. But the question is, okay, what then? But I think in setting the stage for a new relationship with the peoples of the region, I think it's important for President Obama to acknowledge some of these past misdeeds.
And so now he's taken actions this week, or I should say the Obama administration has taken actions this week. They have now frozen the assets, I guess, in this country of Assad of Syria and five or six of his ruling, I guess, administration. But how does it, and I guess one could argue that the intervention with Libya is also consistent with, I guess, supporting a democracy movement. They were a little late in the game, it seems to me, with Mubarak, but at the end we're in the right place. But how do they circle the square with something like Bahrain?
Well, again, I think, I mean, that's a good question, because the fact is, I mean, we have right here an almost kind of a classic example of a values and interest tension. I mean, our values are clearly on the side of democracy, more freedom for people in the Middle East, and an end to these authoritarian regimes. But at the same time, we do have interests, serious interests, oil. There's no denying that. And we do want, governments that will work with us against the problem of extremism and terrorism. And the fact is, we're going to have to continue to work with some governments whose policies, you know, elements of which we don't like. And Bahrain's a perfect example of that. We have the Fifth Fleet base there. That's an important element of U.S. influence and power in the region. So I think the real needle that Obama's going to have to thread here is maintaining a consistent position on principles of freedom and democracy and accountable governance, while at the same time recognizing the fact that the U.S. won't be able to do the same thing in every country, although hopefully we'll be able to kind of come up with a set of policies that do point in the same direction in all of these places.
That's a really thin... that's a really tough needle to thread, it seems to me.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, I don't know how you say, like, freedom counts in Syria, but not so much in Bahrain. Or, I understand, but it seems either like we're going to either be dictated by these values or mm-hmm. by our sort of strategic interests. And, you know, hopefully, I suppose you could say, hopefully these things will correspond. But when they don't, you know, this is on the side of the ledger we're going to fall, I guess. And I guess it's just a question of whether or not he can sell that to the broader Arab world. And let's talk about economic aid, because supposedly there's going to be some big debt relief for Egypt. There's going to be some other economic aid. Do you think that, address that for a minute. Give me your sense of how important that is and why.
Well, I think it's very important because understanding that what's driving so much of these demonstrations is the complete lack of economic opportunity. Many of these demonstrators are well-educated, but they don't, you know, they've gone to college, they have degrees, and they have real skills, but they have no opportunity to apply those skills and make a better living for themselves and their families. And so that's what's driving a lot of this resentment, I mean, on top of just the basic lack of political freedom, which is, of course, important too. But I think understanding, and I think it's an important understanding that the administration has, that economic aid and allowing, you know, just kind of building these economies are part of what are going to create these democratic constituencies that will stabilize and create, you know, stable polities in these countries. But I would just kind of caution, I think while that's good, I think there's a danger of getting too small bore and getting too into the weeds on these kind of economic reform issues, because even though they're important, I think the president needs to kind of swing for the fences a bit more here. I mean, really to kind of reestablish a relationship and create a vision for the future relationship of the United States with the peoples of the region, not just the governments, but with the peoples of the region, something that's really been lacking.
Now, I mentioned Bahrain, but I mean, obviously, I think the biggest... complaint, I guess, and from my perspective, on the legitimate one, would be the plight of the Palestinian people. I mean, we in the past week have seen massive peaceful demonstrations by Palestinians on the borders of Israel and in the West Bank. How do we address this? I mean, give me your sense. You're in Tel Aviv right now. What is your sense of just how far Obama's willing to push Israel at this point? And is there any pushing Israel? I mean, is there really anything that America can do at this instance?
Well, I think there's a lot America can do, but I think, first of all, the Netanyahu government, obviously, I think, has shown itself to be pretty intransigent on a lot of these questions. I mean, the settlement issue, for example, this wasn't a new request from Obama. This was actually, the settlement freeze was a pre-existing Israeli commitment under the Bush roadmap. But again, the way that the debate tends to occur in the United States, it was presented by many people as, oh, this is a new and outrageous request by the Obama administration. But the fact is, it does play politically in the United States against Obama, were he to really kind of take a harder line, and use some of the tools, whether, you know, economic aid or military cooperation. There are a range of options that President Obama, has, were he to really decide to pressure Israel. And I think, given the, you know, just the bare facts of the American political calendar, President Obama is unlikely to do that. Now, there's also the real gaps between the Israelis and the Palestinians on some key issues, such as the right of return, which is a major, major issue for the Palestinians. Just not only a recognition, but a return of some significant number of Palestinians who lost their homes in 1948 and 1967. And that's a red line for the Israelis. So that is probably going to be one of the toughest issues to overcome. I think it can be done. I think people have a number of formulas and ideas for how to do it. But at this point, we don't seem to have two governments that are really genuinely able to sit down and do that work.
There seems to be it seems to be clear at this point that at one point over the next 6 to 8 months, the idea of UN recognition of a Palestinian state is going to come up in the General Assembly, and the United States, I guess, presumably as a member of the Security Council, would have an ability to veto it. How much of what Obama says today can really be taken seriously if it is, in some ways, as you say, a swing for the fences? How much can that be taken seriously if they're not willing, if they in some way, if the Obama administration prevents the recognition, UN recognition of a Palestinian state in September?
Well, I think it would be taken very seriously by the Palestinians. I mean, the role that the U.S. has in this process is still, it's a very significant one. But, I mean, the Palestinians, the use of this kind of international recognition process is kind of a vote of no confidence in the ability of the United States to act as a real honest broker. I mean, they have real influence and real control over the process, but they've just not, according to the Palestinians, and I would agree with their view that thus far it's not really been behaving fairly. But if they did go to the UN, and I would say that this process, you know, they are really, it looks like they're very serious about going for it, but it's also a form of pressure on the United States to produce different behavior by the United States on the peace process. If they did go for it, I mean, I think most analysis I've seen thinks that they will succeed. Even if the U.S. tried to oppose it, if they got enough support in the Security Council, they could then go to the General Assembly to get this recognition, and which would then, once they are recognized as a state, would trigger a whole host of other legal mechanisms that they could then enter into as a member state, such as the International Criminal Court, that could create a lot of problems for Israel as an occupying power.
Interesting. And just lastly, tell me, what impact do you think this is going to have domestically? I mean, to pressure Israel, this puts Florida into play, I guess. I mean, in the crudest sense, and you know, the idea that Obama would be, I can already hear the Republicans in the Senate talking about, we can't afford $1 billion worth of debt relief to Egypt. Does at least on that side of the ledger, in terms of actually Obama reaching out, putting aside, you know, providing some legitimate pressure on Israel. Did the killing of Osama bin Laden in some way neutralize a lot of the Republicans' ability to sort of get wider traction on the idea that this guy loves Arabs because he's a secret Muslim?
Yeah. No, I think you'll always have people saying that, but I think to a great extent it did really kind of seriously diminish that argument. I mean, they've been saying all along Obama was weak, he didn't know how to make a decision, and now he's pretty much, as far as American national security politics goes, he pretty has the ultimate demonstration that when it comes to it, he knows how to throw down.
Was this speech a function of killing Osama bin Laden?
I don't know if I would quite say that. I think, you know, you've got Netanyahu coming here for the AIPAC convention and, you know, for this meeting with Obama. You've got, I think it's a combination of these things. I think some have remarked that, you know, you're kind of there, the Palestinians, the Israelis, and the Americans are in some senses in a race to define terms. So I would say it was partially had to do with Netanyahu's visit. It partially had to do with Osama bin Laden. And it partially had to do with the fact that a lot of people, myself included, have really been, you know, asking when is President Obama going to lay out a vision for the new Middle East. I think it's been overdue. So I think, you know, regard to the domestic politics of it, look, I think some people are always going to see Obama as anti-Israel, but I think there's an opportunity here for President Obama to say, this is a function of America's close relationship with Israel to help, you know, to help reassure Israelis that they've got more to gain in a democratic Middle East in which they are legitimately and genuinely integrated and not seen as a pariah state, because the idea that you can just continue to build up Fortress Israel is just not realistic and it's not sustainable and it's not a life I think many Israelis want to live.
Matt, I have a sense that American Jewry's perspective on Israel has changed over the past 5 or 10 years and is, I think, still very sympathetic to Israel, but is less so. And maybe that assessment is wrong, but that's certainly my sense, that there is that the connection that American Jewry has felt with Israel has diminished in some respects. I mean, it's still, I think, powerful, but it's diminished. Does this come into play? Is there a sense that in Israel they are aware of this? Do they care about it? Am I making this up?
No, I think I don't know if I would use the term diminish, and you know, as far as Israelis I speak to, yes, they're very aware of it and they're very concerned about it, but I think many understand, and my own view of it would be, it's just, I think many American Jews are less inclined to give Israel a free pass on certain policies. I mean, it's of course they're still supportive of Israel, but I think Israel has been engaged now in this over 40-year occupation. Its policies toward the Palestinians are deeply unfair, and many liberal Americans, Jewish or non-Jewish, are uncomfortable with those. So it really comes down to, yes, it's important to support our allies, but it's also important to call upon our allies to adhere to democratic values.
Well, Matt Duss, Director of Mideast Progress from the Center of American Progress, I enjoy I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to us about this, and thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
All right. We've got to take a break, folks. In fact, we are going to end the program now. We're a little bit late, and we'll go into the post-show. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call me at 646-257-3920. You can Skype call us. What's the word for that? Skype the show at Majority Live. Maybe we should sort of congeal those or even put it on the blog. That might be good, too. People complain about that a little bit. Folks, become a member, blah, blah, blah. You know the whole spiel. Keep buying through Amazon. Buy some coffee at justcoffee.coop. Why? Because the coffee is delicious. The tea is delicious. The chocolate, delicious. It's all fair trade. It's a great company. They support the show. I don't know what other reason would you want? It's going to make you very virile. And it's going to brighten your day. It will bring you luck, money, and fame. Tomorrow, Casual Friday. There's a lot of suspense. Will Jimmy Reefer Cake have a legitimate 60-second recap of the news? Will Chris Rosen actually come up with a good selection for movies? Will Cliff Schecter be as funny as normal, or will he be more funnier as we discuss the weekend news? Join us tomorrow, folks, or join me and join me on the flip side at Majority FM. Talk.